Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Well, as I was saying, Australians go to the polls next week as they decide who's going to be in charge of the country. So what important issues are facing them and who could be in charge once votes are cast? For more, I am joined by Graham Finley from the School of Politics and International Relations in UCD. Good morning, Graham.
Good morning.
Before we get down to the issues, can we talk about mandatory voting first, please? How does it work?
Yeah, I mean, Australian politics are absolutely fascinating. And one of the great success stories is compulsory voting. Belgium also has it. But in Australia, you know, you have to register. You can register if you're 16 or 17. But if you become a citizen or if you're over 18, you have to register to vote. And then you have to vote. And if you don't, there's a $20 fine, which not that many people seem to want to evade because they have well over 90% voter turnout in every election.
How is it extracted from you if you don't vote?
I think it's just like a regular civil fine. They know where you live. You're on the register of electors and you'd probably get it in the post. I don't think they come to you very heavy-handedly. Like, they're not going to knock on your door looking for your voting penalty. But, you know.
But
it's like a traffic ticket.
90% turnout,
yeah,
that
over.
Has to have a very significant impact on the shape of governments.
It does, and it makes them less predictable than you might think. The Australian system is really fascinating. They have proportional representation, single transitive vote for their senators. Half of the Senate is elected every election, usually. I mean, it could be otherwise, but normally it's half the Senate. Like in the American system, the senators have a bigger role to play than, like, say, the Senate of Canada or other former British colonies. The House of Representatives, again, a bit like the United States, is elected by a preferential vote, like basically PRS TV only for only one sitting member.
And it's from there that the government is drawn or it is decided.
The government is drawn from the House of Representatives. These elections are like a by-election in Ireland or the election for the president of Ireland, which you were just talking about. So, you know, the government's drawn from the House of Representatives, but the Senate plays a really crucial role. And the PRS TV part of the Senate means it's quite unpredictable. At the House of Representative level, there's a very strong two-party system. You know, they've got the Labour Party, you've got the Liberal National Party, parties, which are referred to as the coalition. And leaders' debates are only between the two leaders of the coalition and the Labour Party. But at the Senate level, because of PRS-TV, you get a lot more of a mix. And you see, you know, very strange results. There are upsets at the House of Representatives level, but at the Senate, you know, the legalized cannabis party, for example, may end up holding the balance of power in the coming Senate. So
how Australian.
Yeah. Oh, they've got some wonderful parties there.
Coming back to the two main parties, though, Labour and the Liberal Coalition, what's the difference between them?
That's a great question as well. The rhetoric of Australia and the actual behavior in the chamber is notoriously rowdy. People really mix it up there in terms of politics. Economically, there's not a lot of difference between them.
I mean, Tweedledum and Tweedledee?
The Labour Party has become so centre-left that they're thinking about dropping the word socialist from their platform and their founding statements. The coalition is quite conservative culturally, and, you know, over the years has gone back and forth in terms of just how anti-immigration is or just how skeptical it is about recognizing Indigenous people's rights in Australia. But economically, you know, you see it in this election. People are arguing about, you know, I'm going to put this much more in your pocket, or this is how I'm going to help first-time buyers buy a house. You know, these are my plans to reduce the cost of living.
A hair's breadth of a difference between them, yet Australian politics is incredibly polarized. Is it essentially just tribal?
There's a bit of that, but, you know, they've had a very large undecided quotient in all the polls. So the Labour Party, I mean, again, it's not unlike Canada. The Labour Party has been in power, but not for as long as the Liberals in Canada. And it's been creeping up in the polls, largely due to the Trump effect. And so in the broader poll where small parties are factored in, like the Greens, who've been doing a little better of late and in the last few elections as the biggest small party, you know, the Labour is just slightly behind the coalition. But in a head-to-head matchup, Labour has pulled out to sort of 5%, even though there's a very large over 30% rump of people who are still saying they're undecided.
So Anthony Albanese and the Labour Party are something of a known quantity because we've been looking at them for the last couple of years. What have the coalition got to offer?
Well, they've got Peter Dutton, who's really the face of the coalition, who replaced Scott Morrison, who basically lost the last election to Albanese through a series of personal scandals. You know, going on vacation while your country's on fire doesn't look good to the public.
And it's not good.
It's not good, period, yes. Peter Dutton is much more conservative. He's from they have four factions in the coalition, or just in the Liberal Party itself, you know, and he's in the hard right faction. So he's as close to the more conservative National Party as you're going to get. And his persona really reflects that. He's really struggled to find a message because, and again, like Pierre Poilievre in Canada, it's odd that they are just moving out their manifesto points now. But of course, they're not in government, so they have to come up with something to run on. But anyway, he has really stumbled, and the party has stumbled to get things going in the age of Trump. Much of the last debate involved him recognizing that he'd made a misstatement when he said that Russia was building an airbase in Indonesia. And it's hard to, you know, make it work on the trail, campaign trail, if you don't really have a clear set of policies you're running on. He's in favor of nuclear power because energy costs and also access to energy is a huge issue in Australia, big, hot country with lots of mining and industry and everything. But Australia has historically not had nuclear power, so that's controversial. Again, they're casting around the coalition for something to give them an edge over Albanese, and they're really being undermined by Trump. Trump is really good for center-left incumbents in the world because people are going towards Albanese in a time of crisis because they think he represents stability. And the association of the coalition with Trumpian-style rhetoric, whether it's on immigration or whether it's some of its candidates actually saying, make Australia great again, which is not the brand you want to have right now, no. has left them, you know, playing catch up. And, you know, while the two parties are sort of neck and neck on most of the issues, on cost of living and the housing crisis, Labour is well out in front.
That's what I was going to say to you, that you mentioned the Canadian election there. And I was wondering, to what extent do the concerns of the electorate in Australia mirror those of the Canadians and so many elections that it's about the cost of living, stupid.
Yeah, I mean, it's across Western bourgeois democracies, you know, and lots of other countries as well. Like the cost of living, the inflationary period all countries seem to have gone through for the most part, changes to the global housing market, which has seen a lot of big corporations come in, but then also a rise in the cost of materials and so forth, has led to, as in Canada, as in just about any country you care to name, a huge concern with how people are going to get on the property ladder and people are going to afford what Australians, Canadians, people in wealthy societies, especially white settler colonies, view as a decent house, you know, like, and, you know, they've tinkered around with some of the financing instruments, and they've promised sort of help to buy schemes. But in the end, one of the concerns for the coalition is that people might just give up and say, well, look, everybody's suffering from a cost of living crisis, from a housing crisis. You know, there's not much we'll be able to do about it. So, you know, why would I jump to another possibly riskier alternative?
Australia is in a really tricky foreign policy position at the moment. I mean, talk about a rock and a hard place. For decades now, they have forged an alliance with the United States, but their economy is also hugely dependent on China. That's a very uncomfortable place to be right now.
It is fascinating. And I think, like Canada, these countries, which are relatively huge physically, but relatively small in terms of population, almost 28 million people in Australia, they tend to be sort of real takers in the international arena. And unlike Canada, which is wedded to a much larger and more powerful neighbor, you know, Australia is very far away from its ideologically sympathetic ally in the U.S. So only about 5% of exports go to the United States. Trump put the very minimum level of tariffs on them of 10%. So that means that they have to chart their own course between the U.S. and they recently joined a defense arrangement with the U.S. and the U.K., the AUKUS defense arrangement, which is going to involve them not buying French submarines and then buying U.S. nuclear submarines and building some of their own. Who are those submarines targeted against? Well, China, which is encroaching further and further and being more aggressive in the Pacific and in the East China mm-hmm. and South China Seas. And for Australia to align itself with a faraway power like the U.S. against China is complicated because China is their biggest trading partner, and China sends a lot of international students there. China is increasingly throwing its weight around the region, along with Indonesia, a fat, huge country, mm-hmm. Much closer to them. So Australia has to tread really, really carefully.
And a position that can only become more fraught as America disengages from Europe and pivots genuinely this time towards the East and Asia and China in particular.
But not in a very friendly or cooperative way, right? I mean, it's a very conflictual approach mm-hmm. and for Australia to sign on with that, and it was already in the Five Eyes, intelligence sharing network, is something they've been trying to navigate. And China is not slow to express its displeasure and really does have a huge economic influence over Australia. I mean, you think about Australia. It's a huge resource, mineral producing country. What does China need? Minerals. It's going to be a factor. So recently, China approached Australia to ask as part of its general Pacific sort of let's join hands in the Chinese phrase to resist these American tariffs. And Australia politely declined.
So all of that considered then, is stability the watchword of the moment? Does that give Labour and Albanese the big momentum?
It does seem to be appearing that way. People are, in these uncertain times, moving towards stability. Albanese, or Albo, as he's frequently referred to, does seem to be feeling the momentum. He seems very confident. He's won these debates in the views of the undecided voters who they poll immediately after them. They really do seem to have recovered from the disadvantages of being an incumbent in an age of a cost of living crisis. It's all to play for, though. There are a lot of undecided voters out there. There have been a lot of upsets, even in the House of Representatives in the past. And again, the Senate is a wild card. Currently, the Labour government is working with the Greens and some left-wing independents in the Senate. But in the past, they frequently had to work with the coalition to pass legislation. Okay. Obviously, that's going to temper any progressive moves they want to make.
And with so many undecided voters and mandatory voting, meaning that they will end up voting, presumably people have to be very, very, very careful in those last few days, because that's when minds are made up.
Yeah, and I think the gaffes and the missteps of the coalition, they're not fatal. It's all to play for, but something big could emerge, whether it's an external threat or whether it's some internal crisis or gaffe, which could decide people at the last moment.
Graham Finlay, thank you very much for coming into us this morning. Still to come on the programme before 12 o'clock, we're going to be back in Rome and in Buenos Aires, as well as talking to Leo Varadkar on the meeting he had with the Pope in 2018. US Defence Secretary Pete Hegseth is embroiled in yet another leak of war plans, allegedly, I should add. But coming up after the ad break, how to create a good morning routine to get the best out of brain and body.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.